I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drumm from Notre Dame University. Are you in Fremantle today, Martin?
I am indeed, very much so.
Thursday morning, Anzac Day, Martin, I wandered up to the top of Monument Hill to the War Memorial, and a beautiful service took place, a lot of people there. There was something magical about it, strangely a little bit like going to the football at Optus when the Dockers are playing. There are people coming from every direction going to the summit. And literally at Monument Hill, that's what they were doing. And then there were Abide By Me and Amazing Grace. There were speeches. There was the didgeridoo, Welcomes to Country. And there was a feeling of quiet around the place. It was quite touching. And as I walked away and down the hill afterwards, I reflected on what things were like when I was a protesting student against the Vietnam War and how Anzac Day seemed to be an excuse for glorifying war. Lo and behold, I got back to the proverbial office at Fremantle Shipping News and the editor arrived from Sue Booth, raising just that question, a powerful letter to the editor, which our listeners will want to read. Martin, you're a bit younger than me, but do you have a sense, do you think from your understanding of history and political science that there might have been a time when we glorified war and Anzac Day was the pinnacle of the glorification? Is it like that today?
It's a really good and profound question, and it's the right time to reflect just after Anzac Day. And your letter to the editor, she did raise some really interesting points. And I'm a little bit younger, but even back, I think in the 1980s, there was often a different theme and a different feel to Anzac Day. I think it is being done better now. I think it is much more reflective. It's often the speeches reflect on the horrors of war. And sometimes the futility of war, whilst at the same time admiring the sacrifices of people that are sent off to war. Because it's worth remembering that the people sent off to war, they didn't necessarily choose that war. And we've actually gone through conscription, and I think it's particularly your generation, Michael, that was impacted. My father was conscripted, got sent to Malaya. Many people were sent to Vietnam, experienced great horrors, and that impact on their entire lives. And then when they came back, people that rightly had concerns about the Vietnam War, probably some of them took them out on the veterans as well, whether even though the veterans went there, some of them involuntarily. So, but I think we are better at doing this now. I'm not saying that we don't go to every single service, Mike, we don't hear every speech, but I think it is more reflective in its tone than it has been in the past. That's a healthy thing. Like you, I regularly attend Anzac Day services, I think probably to remember the sacrifices of some various people in my family going back a number of generations. So my grandfather served in World War II. So there's I think a lot of us have different connections in one way or another around this.
We do. My grandfather and his horse left Fremantle in August 2015 and got to Palestine, where he saw action in Beersheba, a famous battle there. And you're forced to reflect about the fact that, as you've just pointed out, the Australian wars, apart from the wars with our Indigenous people when the British arrived, have usually been fought, inevitably been fought, you might say, somewhere else. They went off to the Boer War in South Africa and fought for the Brits. We joined the Brits because we still thought we were part of the British Empire. And we went to Gallipoli, we went to Flanders. We've been everywhere with the Americans, it seems. Is it inevitable that we're going to have wars, or can our correspondent's request, Sue Booth's request, that our government work harder as a peacemaker, in effect, to stop them happening, can that be realised?
I'm a bit of a pessimist about eradicating warfare altogether. I don't think that's what history shows us, but I think we can certainly work much harder to try and prevent these conflicts from taking place in the first place. And part of it is around dialogue. It doesn't mean that we need to be best friends with people that we disagree with or approve of some of the things that they do. But I think that often when you have dialogue and when you have understanding, that can be helpful. It can prevent conflict at various times. Some people would argue that deterrence is necessary. I think that's being argued somewhat in Ukraine and Eastern Europe at the moment. But that does necessitate ever greater armament, deterrence. And in World War, in the Cold War, there was a lot of deterrence. And fortunately, we didn't see a major conflict, direct conflict between the USSR and the USA at that time. But the amount of money that was spent on armaments on both sides that could have been spent on social programs would have been extraordinary. So communication and dialogue will go some way to trying to prevent these conflicts in the first place.
Let's just talk again about Russia and Ukraine. It's a protracted battle now. It looked like the Russians were on the march again. You even hear people on the radio assuming it's inevitable Russia will succeed in that conflict and take over, presumably Ukraine. But the resolve of the NATO, Western European, Middle European countries, plus the US, seems to suggest otherwise. What's your take, Martin?
If you look away from the general narrative that you see in your papers, actually the Ukraine's been struggling of late. The last few months have been pretty tough. They've waited a long time for additional aid to come from the US. This particular aid package that was recently passed languished in the US House of Representatives for months, and that probably didn't help them. It'd be interesting to see now that that's gone through both houses of Congress, whether the aid reaching Ukraine will make a difference. It should make a difference in the defensive side of things for Ukraine in particular. So Russia's been launching a lot of drone attacks of late. But I'm still very pessimistic that you'll actually have a military solution to this conflict that sees, say, Russia kicked out of Ukraine. I don't think that's going to happen. So it's, at some stage, there'll still have to be that political solution.
I mean, the cynics always say, always have said that it's the military industrial complex that is always the winner in these battles. Whether it was groups in Nazi Germany making armaments and being paid for it all, whether it's all of the large, well-known American companies making the rockets, the missiles, which are being sent off to Ukraine. I mean, the whole thing just seems to feed on itself, Martin. It's as if conflict with the latest weapons available is built into our DNA. We have to do it.
Well, there's still huge amounts of money spent, particularly in the US, on armaments, and certainly in a range of other countries like China and Russia and other places as well. And military technology is a source of great investment as well. So countries are always trying to outdo one another in that respect. The idealist in all of us should suggest that we'd much rather see that address all sorts of issues like disadvantage and poverty and inequity and all of those sorts of things. I don't think we're ever going to be free from war, but certainly if we can find ways to create a more peaceful society and have to spend less on war, we're getting it. We'll get a lot of pundits. I don't know if you read them in the paper, Michael, and I mean certain papers and the like that are constantly calling for us to raise the percentage of our GDP spent on defence. And for mine, just a bald number spent on defence doesn't tell anything like the true story. There clearly needs to be some money spent on defending our continent. But defence is also a bottomless pit when it comes to money. So people, it's very, you're getting requests that run into the hundreds of billions of dollars, for instance, for these submarines, with little political oversight, at least, and policy oversight around that.
Martin, we sort of understand war. We seem to understand a whole lot less peace. And there was a time when universities were teaching peace studies. Do they still do that with that name?
It's there's not as much, there's a range of We teach peace and conflict, for instance. We don't have a specific program dedicated to peace studies. And there are some of those, there are various legacy projects. It was a focal point. The named projects were focal points in the sort of 80s and early 90s. So you're not getting as many of those new projects being set up. It's still worth reflecting on the value of peace. Making peace, it often involves uncomfortable compromises on both sides. But until you have peace, you can't have a viable society being built. So I think there's lots of lessons for us in today's world about the importance of peace.
Well, negotiating a peaceful end to a conflict, of course, is probably the best known way to make peace. And we're used to growing up playing cowboys and Indians to having peace treaty with the terrible Red Indians in the wild flat plains of the United States. But treaties go way, way, way back in world relations. Take Israel and Gaza at the moment. The Israelis don't seem to have let up one iota, and the number of dead in Gaza now, I think, is exceeding 35,000. And it's happening daily. Two young children were killed just a couple of days ago amongst the people who were killed. Will there be a peace treaty, do you think, at the end of that? I mean, it supposes that Israel just aren't hell-bent on wiping Gaza out.
I'm pessimistic about a formal arrangement. I think that we will get a ceasefire soon just from international pressure because, let's face it, the international community, starting with the US, has patently failed to solve the situation in Gaza and all of the deaths, which are awful. So the sooner we get a ceasefire there, the better. A formal treaty that goes beyond that. The prospects that look a bit more bleak because until you're getting all of the parties, and that would include the US, it would include Iran, it would include most of the Arab states, it would include some of the other, obviously Israel and the various Palestinian factions, until you're getting a lot of political willpower to make that happen, I'm very pessimistic. And I'm not seeing it at the moment. I'm seeing some desire to push for a ceasefire just because of the horror that we're seeing on our TV screens. But I'm not yet convinced that we'll get something more permanent.
It used to be thought in I think in many ways that good international trading relations would bring about peace, would reduce the opportunity for conflict. And the mantra was 20 years ago to have free trade pretty much internationally. That concept has taken very much a back seat in recent years, Martin. How important are good trading relations and sitting down at the table and looking into each other's eyes to making peace?
I think it's really critical. And yes, it has taken a blow of late, but I wouldn't be throwing it out. I think that countries are always looking at the health of their economy. And if you're creating solid, sustainable foundations for economic relations between countries, that will have a flow-on effect. It should make a massive difference. Fair trade. Michael, where a range of countries see substantive value in communities around that economic relations, would go a long way to resolving international conflict.
Recently, reflecting on money in Australian politics and the idea of the crossbench in Canberra to put to cap on the amount of money that you can receive or you can spend, more importantly, as you pointed out. And we saw this amongst the agreements between the US and Russia in the old days when it came to nuclear warheads. Is there any chance at all, do you think, that the international community could agree to cap their arsenals, what they've got, what sort of weapons they have, agree not to make certain sorts of things that might possibly in the wrong hands or by accident blow the entire globe up?
We're in a situation, we're in a probably better situation than we were some time ago. And there's two points at which where there was a lot of international concern. One was at the height of the Cold War when There was a lot of flashpoints, think Cuban Missile Crisis and a range of others, where it looked like any moment we could be headed off to nuclear war. The second one was actually when the Cold War ended and the USSR collapsed, and there was a lot of states that we knew very little about that had nuclear weapons. So both of those periods are well and truly beyond us. But you know, if you look at what's happening with Israel and Iran at the moment, where the two countries directly attacked one another, you can see how quickly that can escalate. And if that particular conflict flared up again and was magnified, that could be a conflagration on another entire level, Michael, which should worry us.
I've never been able to understand how some of these leaders, particularly the more autonomous authoritarian ones, think when it comes to this sort of conflict. Peace doesn't seem to be their major consideration. There seems to be an apparent willingness to hit the button and not worry too much about the consequences. I suppose against that worry or feeling is that it hasn't happened quite yet, but it does seem to get close. What do you imagine the thinking is of these people? Do they feel that they are actually being cheated out of historical territory and they're duty bound to get it back? Do they just so dislike the other people on religious grounds, for example, that they have to obliterate them? Is it just a grab for power and wealth?
I always see a significant degree of self-interest in political leaders when they do these things, and I'm quite cynical about that. So, if we take a couple of examples, so and you've heard me say this before, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is staying in power because he's at war, and I think that he knows that once peace is made, that his days are numbered. He was unable to actually provide security for his own people. He hasn't made a lot of efforts towards peace. I think there's a growing number of critics in Israel around his government. I'd say the same about Hamas in Palestine. I don't think that they're going to have a strong peacetime role. And I'd say the same thing about Vladimir Putin. I really think that he's tapped into a strain of old school Russian nationalism, which is very strong in Russia and very productive for him politically. And walking that back now would be detrimental to his own personal standing. So he has no intention of doing so. So I see a lot of domestic political priorities in the actions of leaders.
Martin, Australia, as I reflected on earlier, has always found itself bound up quite willingly with its original imperial overlords, the UK, when they seem to be weak partners. At the height of Australia being threatened by the Japanese in World War II, we turned to the Americans and we've stuck with them ever since. Some questions are being asked about the decline of empires, of course, and how long the American one will last, but it's going to be there for a little while to come. China's on the way. For a country like Australia, there's another option, I suppose, probably not terribly realistic, and you wouldn't want to have a referendum on it. Might we decide to be a nuclear-free country and declare a little bit like New Zealand that we're not going to go to war with anybody?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting notion. We're in slightly different geopolitical setup to New Zealand. They have to get through us to get to New Zealand. but I think the point's a really interesting one, and I don't think we're going to go as far as declaring ourselves nuclear free or completely neutral in a sort of Switzerland sense. But I do think that because of our growing economic relationship with China and other places, that we have to be very mindful about staying out of conflicts where we can. And maybe we're operating in a peacekeeping role in many cases. But I mean, the most contentious conflicts that Australia's always been in have been the areas where we haven't been entering for our own defence, where we're entering a conflict at the behest of other people. Think of Vietnam, think of Iraq, even on reflection, think of World War One. So, yeah, very interesting.
Martin, it doesn't sound to me that you and I should be rushing out into the streets of Fremantle and saying war is soon to come to an end, and there are only clear ways of resolving conflicts that currently exist. Can we count on the United Nations these days?
United Nations is nothing more than an amalgamation of the views of its members. And we see that in both the strengths and weaknesses of the UN. At times, they've been able to aggregate different viewpoints and find ways towards peace. But in many cases, they're completely hamstrung by the geopolitical motives of UN Security Council permanent members. And they include people that are not just observers or watchdogs, but people who are active participants in the events. Think about Israel-Palestine, where the US has been a long-standing ally of Israel and has aided Israel militarily. They're not really a real place to sit back and be an arbiter on this conflict because they're hopefully conflicted. So Russia's got a hand in a whole range of things. They're a close ally with Iran and other places as well. So when your most powerful players have their own agendas, then it's very difficult for the UN itself to make much traction.
Well, perhaps the appropriate way to finish off this discussion, Martin, is to reflect, and each of us might reflect in a different way, on the value and the power of protest. If you're angry about people you consider to be warmongers, if you're deep in your heart concerned about the future of the planet, but taking into account everything we've talked about today and the almost inevitability of conflicts between nations, is there any point in grumbling about it? Do you stop your raging? Is there any point in being a pacifist and telling people that you are?
I think that people demanding peace and demanding an end to conflict make a big difference. And, it's difficult to see the log in our own eye sometimes, Michael, but imagine the bravery of those people in Russia who've been arrested for speaking out in favour of peace there. A lot of difficult conflicts and aggressive conflicts have faced, the people who perpetrated them have faced domestic opposition. And often that opposition's been fairly brutally crushed. So I think it takes a lot of courage of your convictions to speak out against these things. There'll be lots of debates about the best method of doing so, the most constructive way to make your point. There's, for instance, with the Israel-Palestine conflict, there's absolutely a role for people to protest and make their point. I would strongly recommend that people stay away from any negative comments about either Jews or Muslims amongst that. I don't think that's very helpful. And keep that debate focused on the actions of the political actors involved who've really let a lot of people down.
I think I'll give the last word to the poet, Dylan Thomas. Here, Martin, I was kindly reminded of this famous couple of lines by our correspondent, Sue Booth. He said, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." I think we have to rage against the dying of the light. Martin, it's been lovely talking to you about not so much peace, but war and whether one day we might get to peace and how we might do it, but we have to keep thinking about it.
We do. And the things when human rights are, if human rights are important to us all, Michael, we should be interested in peace because war is an aggregation of the violation of human rights. And a lot of the worst violations of human rights occur when war is happening.
Human rights, it's a marvellous expression, so easily ignored, forgotten, trampled on. Thanks for joining me today, Martin.
Thanks, Michael.